Whatever the adventure, there's a BMW engineered to take it on. The X3 delivers a striking design with agile performance. The 100% electric i4 packed with pure electric energy. Or the plug-in hybrid X5, an impressive, versatile SUV granting full control on every journey. Choose what powers your next adventure during the BMW Road Home Sales Event. BMW, the ultimate driving machine.
Hurry in for exceptional offers through December 2nd. Visit BMWUSA.com for details.
It's better over here.
Now at T-Mobile, get four 5G phones on us and four lines for $25 a line per month when you switch with eligible trade-ins. All on America's largest 5G network.
Minimum of four lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees and $10 device connection charge. Phones via 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling entire account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. Bill credits end if you pay off devices early. See T-Mobile.com.
Season 2 of The Sunshine Place is the story of an experimental drug rehab for teenagers called Straight Incorporated, where kidnapping, brainwashing, and torture were disguised as therapy. It's the origin story of the troubled teen industry. How do I know this? Because I lived through it. The Sunshine Place, an Odyssey original podcast in association with Robert Downey Jr. and Susan Downey, is available now on the free Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
If you have not been outside yet, you got some different fall weather. You know what? It's fall, y'all. I've been waiting to say that, and finally I can. It's fall, y'all. Highs of only 65 today, and then 63 tomorrow, 66 on Saturday, warming up to 76 on Sunday. Looking ahead to Thanksgiving, highs of 74 with a 40% chance for showers next Thursday, a week from today. But between now and then, some cool weather, so enjoy it. Right now it's 48 degrees, a lot colder than that in Russia. And Mark Katz joins us now, a professor of government and politics at the George Mason University Schar School of Policy and Government and a non-resident senior fellow at the Atlantic Council. Good morning, Mark. How are you?
Great. Good to talk to you again.
Good to talk to you. I'm sorry the introduction took up all of our time, and we'll try it again next time. Let's talk about what's going on with Ukraine and Russia, and it seems as though, you know, I was reading this story, and I'm thinking that it seems as though both sides are making, well, maybe all three sides, I guess, because you got Ukraine, you got the United States and Russia trying to make moves to get the war wrapped up before former President Trump comes in. I don't know if that's a way to end a war or not. Tell me what's going on, if we can, if you will, please, rather.
Well, I don't think the war is going to end that quickly, but I do think there's a possibility that it could end next year. And I think you're absolutely right that Certainly, Putin on the one hand and the Ukrainian government and certainly the Biden administration are both trying to strengthen their hands. In other words, it's like if everyone wants the war to end, we can agree on that. But what are the terms on which it's going to end? And I think that each side is sort of ratcheting things up. Obviously, the introduction of these, thousands of North Korean troops into Russia has been quite a shock. And so I think that's what triggered the Biden administration to allow Ukraine to use these Army tactical missile system known as ATACMS hitting into Russian territory.
Let me take a step back for people who were so wrapped up in the U.S. election, they kind of lost track of what was going on there. What prompted North Korea to get involved in this, and why would Putin and Russia want North Korea involved?
Well, I think for Putin, there's that the more troops from other countries, that means sort of the fewer Russians that have to be fighting. He has suffered, hundreds of thousands of casualties. The Russian tactics are extremely wasteful of human life, and that this is something that they at some point, it's not that they're going to run out of men, but that they're going to have to resort to conscription. That'd be highly unpopular. So if you can get the North Koreans to fight, that's fine. Now, why they're doing it? It's actually at a seminar yesterday downtown Washington. And basically, the North Korean leader, he gets money. It's sort of estimated that each North Korean soldier is being paid $2,000 a month, and the most of that money is going to the government, to the North Korean government, not to the soldier. he has his own reasons for being willing to send his troops to North Korea, to Russia.
So what is the situation in Russia with the military and who serves and who doesn't? And are people, you know, like you talk about the Russian military strategy not being terribly considerate of human lives and just kind of feeding them into the grinder. Who would want to join the military in Russia? And what is the situation there, Professor?
Well, that's a good question. And it seems that they are, you know, pulling in something like 30,000 people a month. And you know, the people whom they're bringing in tend to be you know, the very poor. Obviously, there's criminals. Now it appears that they're people just charged with crimes, and this is a way to avoid going to prison. You know, it's and they're being paid as well. In other words, that their families will get a payout. You know, if these people die, which they do in great numbers, so there's a, you know, so far he's been able to keep it up, but obviously this is you know, a really expensive way to fight a war. That's for sure.
What about losses? You know, you keeping score. I hate to put it that way, but you got to look at raw numbers, I guess, and you got to look at the proportions. Ukraine and Russia, who's taking the worst of it, or is there a way to determine that?
Well, yeah, there are people who focus just on this, and obviously Ukraine has far fewer people to lose, and so I think that's the calculation on the Russian side, is that they can take pain longer than Ukraine can. And I think still, you know, Ukraine, you know, the conscription age is, I think, 25, and that was, you know, that was actually lowered recently. In other words, they're not conscripting, you know, 18 through 24 year olds, you know, that would be really unpopular, but at some point they're going to have to do that, it seems to me.
Let me take a break, Professor. When we come back, I want to talk about this ICBM that Russia launched. I think when a lot of people hear intercontinental ballistic missile, they automatically jump to nuclear weapons, which is not the case here. If y'all have any questions or comments about what's going on between Russia and Ukraine, and we'll also, when we come back, get to how this thing's likely to wrap up and how do you decide the winner and what that looks like. You can text them into the Oakmont Jeweler Talking text line at 504-260-1870. We're talking to Mark Katz, professor of government and politics at the George Mason University Schar School of Policy and Government, non-resident senior fellow at the Atlantic Council, and also how President Trump's administration could change what happens over there in opposition or as opposed to President Biden's administration. 620, time for traffic now, WWL. All right, 625, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to Professor Mark Katz. He's a professor of government politics at the George Mason University Schar School of Policy and Government, non-resident senior fellow at the Atlantic Council. He knows what he's talking about when it comes to Russia and Ukraine. Professor, nothing can be said this day without an age, without a political comes through a political prism, it seems like. Somebody texts in and says, stop this lame duck president from putting us into World War III. That comment aside, talk about the political implications, I guess, if you will, of Putin preferring to deal with Joe Biden or Donald Trump, Zelensky willing to deal or wanting to deal with Biden or Trump. Tell me about that whole troika, I guess.
Sure. Well, first of all, the Ukrainians are fed up with Biden. There was, yes, he supported them, but put so many limitations on them that they, in fact, a lot of Ukrainians are hopeful that Trump will actually do more. He'll do something more dramatic, that's for sure. You know, I think that a lot of this talk about, you know, World War III or whatever, the people who have objected to this, who support Trump, aren't the ones who are in top foreign policy making positions or been appointed to. What I think is telling is that Trump himself has not come out and criticized this move, nor has anyone whom he has appointed to State Department, Defense Department, Intelligence. In other words, the people who have done this, I think it's Don Jr., Marjorie Taylor Greene, they're not going to be doing foreign policy making. And as Trump's own communication director pointed out, that its official statements on this matter will come directly from President Trump or his authorized spokespeople. And I think this is very telling. I actually think that that this move, instead of limiting Trump, it actually helps him. That he can come into office. And Biden has done this, but Putin might not want to react strongly because he doesn't want to hurt his ties with Trump. So Trump can come in and argue that, well, it wasn't him that let Zelensky hit Russia with the attackums. But, if Putin wants Trump to reverse Biden's decision, well, then Putin needs to make some concessions of his own. So I actually think that, Biden and Trump, they talked for 2 hours. It strikes me that this may have been, if not, explicitly coordinated, that Trump knew what was going on.
And that would be in the best interest of the country. Certainly, when something like this is going on, you got a new administration coming in, which, if that's the case, Professor, that gives me hope and makes me feel good. Tell me about the ICBMs. People tend to link that with nuclear weapons, but that's not what Russia did, correct?
Correct. I mean, the Ukrainians have claimed this was an intercontinental ballistic missile. I don't think this has been confirmed yet. And also, of course, you can put a nuclear warhead on a missile that fires, any distance, whether short range, medium range,
that's
long
a good
range.
Point. For Russia to launch a missile in Ukraine with a nuclear warhead, it doesn't have to be an ICBM.
Not at all. And I think it's, one can say, well, is this a warning that we could use ICBMs? Or is it just that they run out of other kinds of missiles that this was the one that they had available? And I would, sort of the more sinister explanation is probably less likely than just the, this is, sort of the spur of the moment kind of decision making might have been in effect here. So I wouldn't read too much into this ICBM story. A, we're not sure it was an ICBM, and B, they don't need an ICBM for launching nuclear weapons, that's for sure.
Professor, we only have a minute left, but the politics of this, to me, my ignorant analysis that Putin has got to be sorry he started this, and now we got to find a way for him to gracefully exit. Is that accurate at all?
I think that's what he wants. I think we're now talking about the terms. I think what Trump has made clear is that, Ukraine can't have, isn't going to get this territory that you occupy back, but that, Trump's or Putin's other demands, like Ukraine has to have a government friendly to Russia and maybe no link to NATO. I think that this is something that's open for debate. And I think what we're doing here now is arguing about the terms of the ceasefire and what position each side is going to be in.
And in a negotiation, obviously, people that know that even if you have somebody beat, sometimes in order to end it, you got to give them an out, right? Craft an out for them.
That's right. And so I think what people I think are also understanding is that Putin is in a desperate situation. I mean, he is losing so many men that at some point he's going to have to, his own military is not happy with having to lose so many men.
Thank you, Professor. Appreciate your time as always. Hope you have a nice Thanksgiving. We'll take a break. Come back. Talk to Andy Smith, director of the University of New Hampshire Survey Center, about the incoming President Trump administration. Time now, WWL First News. 6:44, 16 till 7. It's fall, y'all. Nice. Temperatures in the 40s outside, going up to only the upper 60, mid-60s today. 65 for a high, 63 tomorrow, 66 Saturday, 76 on Sunday. And then warming a little bit toward Thanksgiving, unfortunately, highs in the mid-70s with a 40% chance for showers, so not hot, but not really fall-like either. Somebody texted me yesterday, when are you going to have Andy Smith on, a guy from New Hampshire? When does he come on? Why hasn't he been on a long time? Well, he comes on just about once a week, and he does have a life. He does have things to tend to. We'd love to have him on 4 hours every day, but Andy, you do have other considerations, do you not?
I do. My wife probably thinks it'd be best if I were just out of the house, but that you can't deal with that all the time.
Come on down. We'll hook you
all
up.
All right.
We'll do a co-host thing. There's no pay. It'd be a volunteer position, just so you understand that.
Yes, indeed.
Let's talk about President Trump said he was going to shake up Washington, and Lord knows his cabinet picks are in the process, or at least intended to do that, I guess. Thoughts on what the former, President Trump and his cabinet picks?
Well, I think you're right that he has a lot of high visibility picks with essentially no governmental experience and being put in fairly important positions. And it's the TV people. So I kind of look at his picks as kind of the good, bad, and the ugly. The good are the kind of the typical picks. I don't mean good necessarily because of the people, but they're not really controversial. Putting Marco Rubio at State, John Ratcliffe at the CIA, Doug Burgum at Interior. You kind of reward the political people that have helped you out, and they're not that controversial. The problematic ones are the bad ones, and you have people like Lee Zeldin, kind of somebody who has never been known as an environmentalist, being put in EPA. Tulsi Gabbard, with some potential former Democrat, being put in the Director of National Intelligence. And there are a couple others like that, but the ugly ones are the ones that are really problematic. These are the ones that shake things up, and they're the ones that are going to cause the most problem getting through the Senate. Pete Hegseth at Defense, you know, the largest employer in the United States, and he's never really been a high-ranking person, doesn't really understand the way that bureaucracy works. Matt Gaetz at Attorney General, no experience to speak of as an attorney, very controversial issues in his past and lawsuits and ethics complaints. RFK Jr. at HHS, Linda McMahon at Education, Dr. Oz at Medicare and Medicaid. These are people that are his supporters, but largely they're TV people without experience. They're mouthpieces. My concern about those is if they have not had experience running these types of agencies or these types of bureaucracies, then the very thing that Trump wants to do, which is shake up the bureaucracies, isn't going to happen because those bureaucracies are going to go on autopilot, being run by the bureaucrats, not by the people at the top.
Yeah, talk about that, if you will. And you and I have had this conversation a lot, you know, going back to my old poli-sci days in college where, you know, presidents traditionally try to focus more on foreign policy than domestic policy because the bureaucracy is so big. And the bureaucrats in Washington, I don't necessarily mean this in a pejorative way, but that's, their theory is kind of like when, no disrespect to anybody that works here, but let me make it a different place. It's like if a university gets a new president, the feeling is, you know, I got tenure. I don't care. I've been through five presidents. Go ahead, do whatever you want. To make it not a corporate setting, but to flip it over to your side, Andy, it's kind of like that, right? I mean, the bureaucracy is so ingrained. It's hard to come in for any one president to come in and think that they're going to change anything when there is a mindset of, okay, that's fine, that's your thing, but this is my thing, and I plan on being here for 20, 30 years. Thoughts?
Yeah, we just have inaugurated a new president last week, and I think this is about the fourth or the fifth strategic plan that's been initiated by
a new president. Wait, you're talking about the University of New Hampshire?
At the University of New Hampshire.
Yeah.
And so you hear the same sort of thing, and it's true that you can get maybe a few things done that are important, but you just can't push through a large number of things because the bureaucracy is just so difficult to push through. You can't fire people. They've got their ways of doing things. There's old friendships and animosities that you can't really deal with. But if you, as a president of a university, can get two or three things done, that's pretty successful. I think that same is true for a president. If you can get two or three major initiatives through as you're in your presidency, that's pretty good. Taking up the bureaucracy is an incredibly hard thing to do. You have to have the bureaucracies on your side to accomplish these things. You don't want them opposed to you. And if they are opposed to you, then they basically can slow things down, slow walk things, just not prepare you just are fighting against like a giant blob. You push it one place and it just absorbs the punch and it grows out the other side. So getting rid of the bureaucracy, cutting back on the bureaucracy is difficult. The bureaucracy has its own incentives, which are self-preservation.
All right, let me take a break. We'll pick it up when we come back. That's the ugly truth, but it is the truth. Whether and I would ask the people listening, Andy, to apply it to where they work. If it's a regional manager or a general manager or university president, whatever it is what it is. And another thing is that, you know, half of the people maybe were loyal to the old guy, and I'm not talking about necessarily the president of the United States, but the president or general manager or regional whatever. And they're kind of hoping that the new man or woman fails. That's the other part of it that is just human nature. 651, 9 till 7. You'd hope that everybody was on the same page, but that's not the way it always works. Traffic now, WWL. 657, beautiful fall morning, Thursday, November 1st, week out from Thanksgiving. Talking to Andy Smith, director of the University of New Hampshire Survey Center, about President Trump and his cabinet selections. Somebody texted in and said about dealing with the bureaucracy, Andy, so don't try. And that's not what we're saying at all. What we're saying is they're going to be up against challenges. And if you want to change something, not only do you have to run a massive department, but you have to kind of know how it works if you're going to change it, right? And change the parts that need changing and not the parts that don't?
Absolutely. I mean, just basic things like how do you put together the budget for the organization? Not knowing all of the different components of the organization, what it actually they do, which ones have competent people running them or not. You know, you don't know those things if you're an outsider. And then who do you rely on? Well, you rely on insiders. So then you have to have people on your team inside the organization who you can rely on. And that's frankly counter to what most of these people want to do when they get into the organizations. So you're just put in a very difficult position as a manager to be able to find people that you can trust who can actually pull off the things that you want to do, because you, as a good manager, you recognize that what you want to do may not be in the interest of what even your allies within the organization want you to do, let alone what the president wants you to do. So you just really have to pick your battles, pick a couple of things that you can do. And the, one of the things that has been floated that could be helpful is the kind of a change to the 1974 Budget and Poundland Act, which basically part of it says that if Congress allocates money or authorizes money for a particular program, the president must spend it. They can't, you know, take his pen to it and say, we're not going to spend it on this, this, and this, because Congress has already voted and it's been passed into law. So doing something about the Budget Impoundment Act would give the president then more budgetary control over the actual spending in the agencies. But boy, Congress is going to push back against doing something like that. So it's a tough thing. And this is why we've seen attempts to revise, to reform our bureaucracies for decades, going back to the 1920s. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't seem to ever work. The bureaucracy always manages to pull it out.
And that's a political science fact, like it or not. Sorry, that's the way it goes. Thank you, Andy. I appreciate your time. Have a nice Thanksgiving if we don't talk to you again. Andy Smith, director of the University of New Hampshire Survey Center. When we come back, we're going to talk about insurance reform in Louisiana and also about the governor's tax reform plan. All right, here we go. 7:16 now on this Thursday morning, November 21st, week away from Thanksgiving. Beautiful fall morning, man. I'm going to tell you what, highs of only 65 today, and then it gets even cooler tomorrow with highs then only in the lower 60s, and then even a little bit cooler then, and then it warms up by Thanksgiving. So all in all, dry, could be worse. Right now, we're going to talk about the governor's tax reform plan. Andy Knapp joins us, CEO Committee of 100 for Economic Development. Good morning, Andy. How are you? Adam,
hey,
I beg
Adam,
your pardon.
How are you doing? No worries.
Oh, I had Andy from the guy.
I think my mom called me that at birth, and I've been confused ever since.
No, let me change okay. It right now.
Thanks for having me.
For those of you keeping your own scorecard at home, Adam will be batting for Andy. Adam. They always say it twice. Adam.
That's right.
Let's talk about the committee committee of 100. What is it, first of all? Then we'll talk about tax reform.
Yeah, our members are executives across the state who work across party lines to try to get engaged on big public policy issues around the state. And about a decade ago, they actually hired a group called the Tax Foundation, a national nonprofit, to look at, you know, what would be the ideal tax policy for Louisiana. And that's kind of how we came into this conversation some.
Let's talk about, and I see a statement from the 18th from you all about supporting the governor's tax reform plan with eight caveats, but a lot has changed since then. So tell me, I guess, where the current plan stands in the legislature and how you guys feel about the way it's going.
Well, today I think is going to be a pretty monumentous day to that debate. As it stood, you know, 2 days ago, there was a lot of change. There were a lot of changes in the Senate to try to address the price tag of this proposal as different pieces have made it through and not made it through. And that's kind of typically what you see happen, and that's happening here. So they have started out with a 3% individual income tax that went up to 3.75%. I think there's a lot of movement to try to drive that number down again to 3% for our individual income tax across the state. That is an expensive choice. And to do that, they've got to have other revenues so they don't break the bank of the state budget by making that change. I think that's going to be the thing that drives most of the debate of the day.
Just recap again, because it's radio and you can't go back and reread, if you would please again, Adam.
You bet. So the governor proposed a plan of a 3% income tax rate, taking our income tax as individuals from 4.25%, so we about 4.25% today in Louisiana. He's been trying to get that rate to a flat rate of 3%. The way it left the Senate committee 2 days ago was to move that up to about 3.75 to try to keep the numbers in balance. But there's a whole move today to try to find enough money to lower that back down to 3% for individual income tax. And I really think that debate is probably shaping the rest of the debate.
So where's that money going to come from? Sales tax?
So they had started out looking at a sales tax on services that ran into some challenges leaving the House of Representatives. And so without that money from the sales tax on services, there's a lot of desire to try to still achieve this lower rate, flatter rate. So that what they're looking at is kind of continuing to eliminate a bunch of exemptions of the sales taxes, but also trying to potentially increase the sales tax rate to pay for that. And so today, you know, we have this 4.45% state sales tax that we pay. Of course, we pay a local sales tax of around 5%. So they would try to drive that sales tax rate of the state slightly higher to use that to pay for lowering the income tax on individuals.
You know, I think it's interesting. We'll take a break here and pick it up. We come back. This all goes back to the penny sales tax that expired. Then there were three sessions, as I recall, that got it to 0.45%. And that's set to roll off, and that's what we're talking about here. And I think the interesting portion about this discussion is you got to go back and look at it goes to the essential nature of government and revenue and spending. And if that penny had been in place, would we be where we are now? Or if that penny had stayed in place, would everything be rolling along smoothly? Because I guess the caveat, to use your word, would be would government spending then have expanded to spend whatever they brought in with that penny sales tax had it stayed in place, and then we'd be right back where we are. And you can comment on that when we come back. Adam Knapp, CEO, Committee of 100 for Economic Development, talking about the governor's tax reform plan, 721 Traffic Now, WWL. 725, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to Adam Knapp, CEO, Committee of 100 of Economic Development for Economic Development, about Governor Landry's tax reform plan and where it stands now. I posed the question beforehand, Adam, and the history of this 1 cent sales tax that they wanted to get rid of. They did. Then it took three sessions, if I remember correctly, to get it to 0.45, a compromise. And look, these are rough estimates, okay? But that's basically what happened. Accurate?
That's right. And it's been a stable budget environment with the 0.45 for the last, you know, many years. That was back in 2017 or 2018, and now we're back at the place where they knew setting it up that they would have a end to that 0.45. That was the deal to get it across the finish line. That end is next year, and so over the last few months, there's been a lot of talk about a looming fiscal cliff that's been, you know, because of that 0.45. That's also setting up this debate about, well, shouldn't the whole tax structure be looked at? So that's what we're in the middle of.
But it does.
As a review to try to make the whole competitiveness of the state better.
It does make me wonder about the essential nature of state government here in Louisiana and revenue and spending. And if that penny had stayed there, if they had not gone looking, I hate to say looking for a fight, but looking for to make a stand and make that sales tax roll off, which, as I understand it, affects it's a more of a regressive tax, right? So the people that own businesses were not really against the penny sales tax, were they? And I guess what I'm – go ahead.
That's right. Yeah, in general, the sales tax is something that's paid for by everybody. So the business community has seen that as something that's a little bit more fair, that it's on everybody's till. And we as the governor has been phrasing it this session, you make choices in your spending to have these consumptions that you know are taxable in the sales tax. And he calls the income tax, you know, a labor tax. There shouldn't be a tax on our labor. And that distinction is new to the debate, I guess, for us to have that debate. But it is something that's been pretty consistent across tax policy for decades. The Jindal era changes that happened led to the sales tax changes as well. So there's been a cycle of shifts in tax policy over the last 20 years.
So, but again, you can make a case that if that penny had stayed there, not to mention you talk about the state being stable with the 0.45, if the penny had stayed there, maybe we'd be running a surplus. Maybe services that are essential could have been expanded. Maybe education would have been made better. Or you can make the case that maybe the money would have been, you know, as a matter of what you give them, they're going to spend, and we'd still be at this situation. Thoughts?
I think that's right. I think that what we saw when they reduced the penny down to 0.45 was this this goal to try to reduce spending and reduce revenue to the state and to get to a place where it's not going to generate those excesses that you were talking about. The big question for where we are today, though, and kind of looking forward, is our state to state tax ranking, we don't look as good as some of our neighboring states, and a lot of other states have been shifting their state tax policy over the last decade, and Louisiana has really never gone through, or not recently gone through, a massive overall overhaul of its tax structure. That's what we're in the middle of now, is a goal to try to get to a flatter, fairer, more competitive tax structure. As it's proposed, and what may happen over the next day now, If they make changes on the business side, on the personal side, we may find that we are going to be more competitive. Maybe not as ambitious as the governor originally laid out, but we'll look better as a state at the end of this.
When it comes to looking better as a state in competitive rankings, however you want to phrase it, where does sales tax fit into that, Adam?
It's one of the many features. They look at income tax, business tax policy, sales tax, and then the clumsiness of how your structure is set up. You know, we collect sales taxes in all of our parishes instead of a centralized system. All of those things go into an overall ranking of your state. You can look that up at a nonprofit called the Tax Foundation that looks at all of our states. Mm-hmm. That's what really the governor is shooting for, is a more competitively ranked state at the end of this.
I guess what I'm thinking, and maybe this is too simplistic, but if either the 0.45 or increasing the sales tax to a penny would lead to less corporate taxes, making a more business-friendly environment, a 3% income tax, I guess in terms of priorities of attracting outside investment people to move here, that would seem an obvious solution, or is it not that obvious?
No, I think you just nailed it. They're talking about an extension of that sales tax and then using those revenues as ways to lower the income tax and then getting rid of a lot of credits and exemptions. And loopholes in the tax structure. That's generally what the whole debate looks like. That's
so,
right.
So if I'm just a dumb guy from the West Bank and I figured that out 3 years ago, why?
Why is it so hard?
Yeah. Because, again, I'm a dumb guy from the West Bank and I figured that out 3 years ago. Now it seems like we're wasting a lot of time and money. I don't know. Reinventing the wheel.
Well, I think it would have been great to do this years ago. We wrote this report 10 years ago. The governor, when he opened the session, held up a book that was written in 1988 by an LSU professor saying exactly this same game plan. Not about the sales tax, but definitely about having a fairer system. And that's kind of where we're hopefully going to get to at the end of today. It's going to be a big day in tax policy for those who are nerdy enough to care about it.
Yeah, I am. Thank you, Adam. I appreciate your time. As always, we'll talk to Ben Riggs. You bet. Who's nerdy enough to care about insurance reform in Louisiana when we come back right now. Minute late time for WWL First News. 7:45, quarter till 8. Tommy Tucker on 1 week out from Thanksgiving on this beautiful morning. It's fall, y'all. Finally. Temperatures are in the mid, if you average them around the area, I guess maybe around 50 degrees and going up to only 65 today. And that's not going to be until like 3 o'clock this afternoon. So 63 for a high tomorrow, 66 Saturday, warming into the 70s for the weekend on Sunday and Monday. And then by Thanksgiving, they're saying highs of 74 with a 40% chance for showers. Then a front comes through again, highs Friday on Black Friday of only 65. Ben Riggs joins us now, Executive Director of Real Reform Louisiana. How you doing, Ben?
I'm good. I'm happy about this weather.
Yeah, amen. I'll tell you that. So we hear so much about the special session on tax reform in the state and how it's going to lead to keep people from leaving the state and lead to new investment, lead to new people coming here. But and look, I'm all for that. But talk about, if you will, it seems to me the elephant in the room is the insurance crisis that the state has, both when you're talking about property insurance or automobile insurance, and the factor that plays in either companies locating here, people staying here, et cetera.
Oh, sure. Well, I mean, insurance plays a huge role, and without question, the biggest crisis facing our state. But it's going to play a huge role in companies deciding to relocate here, families deciding to relocate here, or stay here. Absolutely. I mean, definitely the elephant in the room that we need to address. Unfortunately, we haven't really done much of anything to address it.
So I guess what I'm wondering is, when it comes to priorities, I don't know how you rank these things, but is the main driver for people leaving and companies not coming here insurance, or is it sales tax, or do you even want to weigh in on that?
I don't even really want to weigh in on it because I have no idea, mm-hmm. you know, what the main driver is for people wanting to leave here or, you know, stay. I can't imagine that paying, you know, the highest insurance rates in the nation, or if not the highest insurance rates in the nation, very close to that, but most certainly the most unaffordable insurance rates in the nation when you compare it to our median income. I can't imagine that being an incentive to come here or stay here.
So let's talk about property insurance in the first part of this, and we'll talk about auto insurance, because I'll just tell you this, and I know you didn't want to weigh in on it, but anecdotally, every time we talk about tax reform, and it's just anecdotal, but the text I get are people saying, I don't care about the taxes. I care about insurance. Insurance is driving me broke, driving me out, et cetera, keeping me from this or that. So let's talk about what has been done so far in Louisiana and compare and contrast with other states that have done similar things, because when it comes to this tax reform, we're hearing, well, that's what other states do. So when it comes to insurance reform, we heard, well, that's what other states do. Let's talk about what Louisiana did and how it compares with other states that made similar changes, or did they make all of the changes? Because you got to compare apples to apples, right, Ben?
Yeah, well, I mean, so in terms of comparing what we've done with what other states have done, it's kind of difficult to keep track of because so many different states pass so many different packages that have, you know, may have this bill or that bill, but not the other bill. And so, like, comparing apples to apples is difficult in that regard. Mm-hmm. But what I will say is this, when we looked at the package that was passed by Commissioner Tim Temple in the last session, my insurance has not gone down. In fact, just the other day, my wife came out and asked me what was wrong with our mortgage payments. And when I went and looked at them, it was because more of it was going to home insurance because we had an increase in home insurance and we had to adjust the amount that we were paying in to make sure that our principal is being paid down. And that's actually something I've heard quite a few people talk about.
You know what I think is getting lost in some of this, Ben, if I might jump in for a second. I think people like maybe you or me have increased the payment. And the insurance company, what's the word I'm thinking of? Where they collect it ahead of time. It doesn't matter. I'm having a brain fog here. But anyway, you know what I'm talking about? They collect the money ahead of time. Escrow. Thank you, Tim.
Sure.
They escrow the funds. Tim Zimmer
there. There you go.
Tim Zimmer saving the day. But where they escrow the money, I increase the payment to pay off more principal. The insurance is going up, and they've not increased my payment or told me I had to increase the payment, but I think what's flying beneath the radar is people that don't examine the statement, like Mrs. Riggs, don't realize the insurance has gone way up. You're not paying attention to it because the insurance company's escrowing it, but that money's not going toward principal. It's going toward insurance. Do you understand what I'm saying?
100%. Yeah, 100%. And it causes a lot of problems for a lot of families, and often they don't catch it very quickly. It's mm-hmm. something that they find out, you know, months later, and then they're playing catch-up. But in terms of the package that was passed, I think if you had to pick a state that's most similar to what we've done, it would be Florida. And Florida's insurance, like that, and that's one of the issues I have, is legislators continually talk about wanting to do what Florida has done. I'm not interested in emulating what Florida has done. They're in the exact same crisis, perhaps the only state in a worse crisis than we're in. And you see insurance rates going up in the state of Florida again. I know that I sound like I'm just sort of beating a dead horse, because every time you and I talk, I say this, but it's just the truth. The proposals that Commissioner Temple is coming up with are going to do nothing to lower your insurance premiums.
Ben, let me take a break. I'm late. You can pick it up right there, okay? Because I think that's a good stopping point. Ben Riggs, Executive Director of Real Reform Louisiana. If you think, and I agree with Ben, if you think this is going to lower your rates, you're crazy. I think the best you could hope for is people to write insurance and the rates to stay where they are, or to go up less than they have been going up. But if you think this is going to bring rates down, you're in the twilight zone. 751, 9 till 8, traffic now, WWL. 757 and a half, Tommy Tucker. Get a text from a friend of mine that is an insurance agent, an independent insurance agent. She says, bingo, the only goal here is to keep insurance companies open and writing right now. Ben, your thoughts?
Yeah, well, I mean, the issue is that if you look in Louisiana over the past 2 years, now granted, I understand that the 2 years prior were the two when we had the big storms. But if you look at Louisiana over the past 2 years for property insurance, our loss ratio, which is a number that says how much of the money that we're paying in premiums insurance companies keep versus pay out in claims. So the lower the number, the more insurance money companies are keeping. Our loss ratio in Louisiana is the second best in the country, which means that insurance companies are keeping more of the premium dollars we pay for property insurance than any other, than all 49, than 49 other states. And in auto, it's 46 other states that they're keeping more money than. So the loss ratios in Louisiana are very good right now. But we're continually talking about increasing premiums. If you compare Louisiana with our peer states, Mississippi, Texas, Arkansas, we have better loss ratios than all four and higher premiums than all four in both property and home. I think there is a considerable amount of data that shows consumers pay lower premiums in states where the insurance commissioner and state regulators do more to scrutinize rate increases from insurance companies. Harvard Business School, in conjunction with one of the Federal Reserve Board of Governors, did an exhaustive study on this in the property insurance industry. And what they found was states that have looser regulations that do not scrutinize rate increases, Oklahoma, Louisiana are two very good examples, pay higher premiums. They effectively end up subsidizing the profit margins for insurance companies in states that have stricter regulations. So in a sense, it's like we're paying more to make up profit gaps in states like California. I think that in Louisiana, we have to look at having more scrutiny of these rate increases, where, you know, unfortunately, when Senator Duplessis asked Commissioner Temple this question here very recently, Commissioner Temple responded that he didn't think it was his job or responsibility to tell an insurance company whether their rate was too high or not.
We got to run, Ben. Thank you. Hope you can come back. We'll talk to People's Health when we come back. Mike Knight stepping in for Dr. B about food insecurity. Tommy Tucker back in a flash. WWL. Eight 13 on a beautiful Thursday morning, week out from Thanksgiving, where we all count our blessings. But unfortunately, nearly one in seven people in Louisiana are food insecure, and that comes out to over 650,000 individuals. That really is amazing if you think about it. That would be like six-plus jam-packed Tiger Stadiums of people that deal with food insecurity every day of their life, more than the populations of Shreveport, Baton Rouge, and New Orleans combined. And that's not just once a week, that's every day. Mike Knight joins us from People's Health to talk about food insecurity and how you can make a difference this holiday season. How you doing, Mike Knight?
Hey, Tommy, good morning. Thank you for having me on. I'm doing well.
Thanks. Beautiful morning, huh?
Oh, man, it's gorgeous. It's a great day to be out.
And I always talk about the difference with food insecurity. Sometimes those of us that are we work hard and we're blessed, though, and we don't have anything in the refrigerator, and it's like, oh, man, we got to go to the store. But for some people, that's not an option. Let's talk about food insecurity. What is it?
You're right, and that's a very good point. You know, we can go and jump in the car and run to do things, but being food insecure, it means that you don't have enough food to live an active, healthy life. And for some people, it means skipping meals or eating small portions. For others, it means consistent meals. I mean, consistent meals without having a little variety or a few nutritious foods.
So we got to, I guess, draw a distinction between hunger and food insecurity?
Right. Yeah, there's two different things. You know, hunger, it's a physical feeling. You know, cause discomfort, weakness by lack of food. It's something we've all experienced at some point in our lives. Food insecurity has a broader meaning. It refers to lack of resources, money, transportation, things that prevent you from having a reliable access to nutritious meals.
How long does food insecurity typically last?
It depends. Some people deal with chronic food insecurity, which lasts for a long time. It's often related to poverty or homelessness, and it's very hard to recover from. For other people, food insecurity is temporary. It may be caused by a sudden life change, like an unexpected layoff or medical expense. It makes it hard to access food for a certain period.
I would imagine that food insecurity can affect health.
Definitely. Absolutely, it does. Our diet, our health, deeply connected. You know, people who are food insecure are more likely to develop long-lasting health conditions. Diabetes and heart condition are two. They have a higher health care cost and more frequent hospital stays. There's a couple of reasons for it. First, a nutritious diet is essential for good health. It fuels your body, boosts your immunity, and strengthens your heart, bones, and muscles. Without enough high-quality food, you don't get those benefits. And also, people who are food secure may struggle to afford healthcare services, from just routine checkups to treatments for serious illnesses. And they may even have to choose between buying food and filling prescriptions. We do see that a lot.
Wow. Who is it that is most impacted by food insecurity?
Our population with people's health. You know, older adults have high rates of food insecurity in Louisiana. Our state has the highest percentage of food insecure seniors in the nation. And then other people with higher than average rates include Black Americans, Hispanic Americans, as well as people who have a disability or a chronic health condition. Either they're unemployed, they don't have reliable transportation, or they might even live in a food desert.
A food desert, what's that?
So these are areas where it's hard to get affordable, nutritious food. You know, food deserts rarely have full grocery stores, so main options for buying food are going to be your local convenience store or fast food restaurants. And locations like that generally have higher prices, lower quality foods, and less variety than a traditional grocery store. And then some people who live in food deserts can't travel to supermarkets and other areas that require transportation. They may be, you know, maybe live in a rural or low-income area where food deserts tend to be and don't have that option.
I think people sometimes don't realize that you can be overweight and still be malnourished, and that's what we're talking about here with Mike Knight from People's Health about food insecurity. What causes it, Mike? What causes food insecurity?
It's a complex issue. You know, according to Feeding America, it usually has multiple causes, such as poverty, unemployment, systemic racism, lack of affordable housing, limited access to health care services is also a contributor.
And People's Health is doing some stuff, right, to help combat hunger this holiday season?
Yeah, we do it all year long. We serve more than 110,000 people with Medicare, most of whom are older adults, and we're always looking to invest in the communities we serve. And the holiday season is a great time to do so. Each year, People's Health partners with Second Harvest Food Bank to host community meals for local councils on aging. Employee volunteers of ours help prepare and serve food while attendees connect and celebrate the season. People's Health also sponsors Second Harvest Food Bank Holiday Meals for Senior Program, which has provided more than 50,000 meals to food insecure older adults over the last 13 years.
Wow. What else does People's Health do to support adults that are food insecure?
So we offer several Medicare Advantage plans with a healthy food benefit. That includes three chronic condition plans for people with diabetes or cardiovascular disease or chronic heart failure. And these plans are new for 2025, and they include a monthly allowance to spend on over-the-counter items and healthy foods. Then we have our dual-eligible special needs plans for people with both Medicare and Medicaid that offer this allowance too, but it's even with more flexibility. Members can also use it to pay approved utility bills, including electricity, water, and internet.
Wow. How can other people help combat food insecurity and hunger this holiday season?
If you live in New Orleans or Lafayette, consider volunteering with Second Harvest Food Bank. You can prepare meals, package donations, deliver food to members of your community, which is a huge help. You can also look for opportunities to, say, stock a community fridge, donate to a food pantry for a school. One of the best things, especially for our seniors, is if you have somebody that's elderly living next door that you know doesn't have a car, doesn't have reliable transportation, go knock on a door, ask them if you can shop for them. If they can't travel to the grocery store.
All comes down to being a good neighbor. We'll talk when we come back more about people that need help with food insecurity, how they can get it. We're talking to Mike Knight. We'll also talk about the continuing open enrollment period for Medicare and what's involved in that, because it can be very eye-glazing and confusing, and Mike will help simplify that a little bit. Well, am I wrong, Mike?
No, you're absolutely right. It can be eye-glazing.
Man, confusing. So we'll talk about all that when we come back. The open enrollment period until December 15th?
7th.
That's what I said. 7th. 8:21 traffic now, WWL. 8:26, Tommy Tucker, WWL, week before Thanksgiving, as we get ready to count our blessings. Nearly 1 in 7 people in Louisiana are food insecure. That adds up to over 650,000 individuals. Just let that sink in for a second. More than the populations of Shreveport, Baton Rouge, and New Orleans combined, but unlike a filled stadium, that's not just one night. That's every day of their life. Mike Knight from People's Health is with us to talk about food insecurity and how you can make a difference this holiday season. We've already talked about maybe, you know, shopping for a neighbor who can't travel a grocery store, or maybe helping them out, or some resources that they can ascertain. Mike, how can people get help with food insecurity?
Best way to do it is they could call the National Hunger Hotline, and that number is, it's 1-866-3-HUNGRY, and a representative can help you find government assistance programs and local resources, including meal sites and food banks.
And, of course, the other thing you do, as you were saying before, shop, donate to a school food pantry, shop for a neighbor, volunteers we were talking about with Second Harvest, or stock a community fridge. Let's talk about People's Health and open enrollment and Medicare and the December 7th deadline. Mike, how do you even begin to navigate this process, and who needs to do something? Because it's not passive if you turn what? Tell me the rules for Medicare, because I haven't gotten there yet.
Right. Yeah, so people turn in 65. They have a seven-month window around their birth month. So they have the 3 months before, the month of, and then 3 months after their when they turn 65. If they want to join a Medicare plan or sign up for Medicare, that's their window of time where they can do it without really incurring penalties or having any extra charges under Medicare. From there, then they need to determine if they want to get on a Medicare Advantage plan, like People's Health. If they're looking for things that, if they're just needing information, we're a great resource. We have our service center over on Veterans at 3017 Veterans that can, they can just walk in, you know, they can make an appointment, they can call us, stop by if they have questions. We are happy to help people out.
When it comes to the different, the open enrollment period, if you don't do it by the December 7th, are you out of luck, or what happens then?
So Medicare sets up October 15th through December 7th, where they really want you to be investigating and looking at plans and making decisions by then. Now, if someone's turning 65 later on in the year, this period of time isn't for them. But if you're already on Medicare, and especially, Tommy, this year, Medicare has changed and closed the coverage gap, which has affected other ways that health plans are covering things. This is a year, really, that people really want to read their policy. If they already have something, they need to go pull out what they got and say, you know, look at the 2025 benefits and see what benefits are going to be. Because most people, if they don't take a look at it, are going to be shocked on January 1st saying, you know, well, I didn't know I had changes to my health plan. So they really want to take a look this year of all years.
And you'll help walk them through that process, right?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. If they have their current plan documents, come on in. If If not, we can show them what we offer. They can take them home and compare them. But time is getting short with that, too. So they definitely want to be making decisions and being active with it.
Very, very valuable information. Thank you, Mike. If you need help, you can call the National Hunger Hotline at 866-3-HUNGRY. Check in on your neighbors. It would be a good thing to do. And if you want to find out more about People's Health, all you have to do is go to peopleshealth.com or call them at 1-800-978-9765. And as Mike Knight was saying, if you want to just sit down and talk to him, go to the People's Health Medicare Center. It's a beautiful facility, 3017 Vets next to Party City. Appointments are recommended, but walk-ins are welcome. We're going to talk Saints and NFL with Jeff Nowak when we come back. Right now, time for WWL First News. 8:45, quarter till 9, Tommy Tucker, WWL. I'm looking at a tweet here from the Saints. Shout out to Stephanie for getting the final Jeopardy answer correct. I don't know when this was on, but the clue was fittingly this team was born on November 1st, 1966, the day the franchise was awarded. And if you don't know the answer was who is the New Orleans Saints, then you're really out of the loop. 8:45, quarter till 9. Like I said, time now to talk to Jeff Nowak, whom I follow on Twitter, and I would suggest you do too, at J-E-F-F underscore N-O-W-A-K. Hey, Jeff, how are you?
I'm doing good. My heat works. I turned it on for the first time this morning, so that's always a good day, or at least the fact that it works is a good day. It's kind of cold. I just remembered it's November, so yeah.
I used to hate that first with the old system, the first cold front, because you can never remember if you needed to light the pilot light or not. Thankfully, with the system I have, I don't have to worry about it, but I'm glad yours is working. Tell me about working, what the Saints' schedule is going to look like with the off week and Thanksgiving and everything else. How are they going to be working?
Yeah, so they're, you know, obviously they're off this week, and I think, you know, mostly it's guys kind of resting. You know, this is one of the more annoying weeks, I think, if you're a player who's dealing with an injury, because on a week that you'd like to maybe disappear, you are still getting treatment. You're still at the facility kind of getting that work done because, you know, those injuries don't go away because you have a bye week. So I think that's most of, you know, if there's work getting done, it's mostly that. Next week, they're going to change it. They're going to change it up a little bit because Thanksgiving is on Thursday. And because they have the bye week this week, they have some flexibility in terms of how they're going to actually get that set up. So I believe they're going to practice on Monday, basically. They're going to turn Wednesday into a Thursday, and then they're going to give the players Thursday off. There won't be a typical practice. So they're actually going to have Thanksgiving to kind of spend at home with their families, which I'm sure the players appreciate. Mm-hmm. And then Friday, you're going to get back into your normal kind of routine of a Friday practice. So, you know, this is I think they probably appreciate having the bye week in week 12 so they can kind of double up on the holiday week, but that's how it's going to work.
You say they do appreciate it?
Oh, I'm sure, yeah.
Yeah. You never know when the season starts, but I'm going to tell you what, and you talked about, you know, you can be a fan however you want last time we spoke, but I got to thinking about what you said, and really, if you think about it, I'm not trying to get anybody's false hopes up here or anything else, but it's all about when you make a run, right? And first of all, I guess you got to take a step back, and it's how deep of the hole that you're in, and when you make a run. But the Saints are getting healthy. That's an accurate statement, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I kind of look at it like they've basically played three different seasons already, and they have a fourth one coming up after the bye week, right? Because, you know, if the first 2 weeks feel like they were played in some kind of alternate dimension, then you had, I honestly, the first 4 weeks, because I think they played well through those first 4 weeks. They just lost two of those games. And then the next five games were just a nightmare with injuries and whatnot. You didn't have your quarterback. You fired a head coach. And then the last 2 weeks have kind of felt like a different team. And so, yeah, now I think if when you're going into this stretch saying, hey, we probably need to win five of these games, if not six of these final six games, yeah, having the bye week kind of going into that where you can kind of reset and kind of set the standard and say this is what we have to do, let's do it, it's probably, you know, probably for the best. And, yeah, you know, Eric McCoy is getting healthier. You expect to have him back after the bye week. You know, a couple other guys are kind of dealing with nagging injuries that you expect to get back. So, you know, it's set up for you. If you play good football, you get rewarded for it. And, you know, one of the more difficult games on their schedule remaining is the Rams game in week 13. But, you know, last year, and I think a lot of people will look at that game and say, hey, well, we saw what happened last year. Why would anything be different this year? Well, last year, you kind of set up on the exact opposite of that rest situation, right? It was a Thursday game that you had to go out west for, and the Saints played like a game that played like a team that wasn't prepared for that game. In this case, you have 2 weeks basically to get ready for it for a West Coast team that has to come face you. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think if you and I do believe that rest does matter. It's not an excuse. It makes a difference in these matchups when you have extra time to prepare versus less time to prepare. It's also a situation where the Saints now run the same offense that the Rams run effectively. So they've been practicing against it all year. The Falcons are their offensive coordinator is a Zach Robinson understudy. I'm sorry, is a Sean McVay understudy in Zach Robinson. So they've faced that offense effectively twice already, and they've played well against it. So, you know, there's reason to think that they'll perform better in that matchup than they did last year, but we'll have to wait and see. But either way, I think that if you're the Saints and you need to go win that game, and then people will start talking about you a little more seriously. But we have to wait to see.
Tim Zimmer, our resident DGen, can look up the stats on this and determine whether or not that 4-hour, 5-hour travel does matter. But I think it really does, especially when you're talking about a long week. Any of us, you know, whenever you fly across the country, it does kind of exact a toll on you. I know these are professional athletes. Let me take a break. When we come back, and look, I'm not trying to build up anybody's hopes or hype anything, but the Saints have won 2 in a row. Buccaneers have lost 4 in a row. Falcons have lost 2 in a row. If you want to talk about going in the right direction, going in the wrong direction, we'll drill down more in the Rams when we come back, too, with Jeff Nowak, WWL Saints sideline reporter. Again, a quick reminder, John Alzheimer, our friend, credit expert, formerly of FICO and Equifax. He's going to spend a 9 o'clock hour with us answering any questions you have about your credit rating or your credit score, which affects how much you pay for car insurance. And a lot of other things. He'll take your questions between 9 and 10, and there are no stupid questions when it comes to this. 8:51, 9 till 9, traffic now, WWL. 8:57, 3 till 9, talking to Jeff Nowak, WWL Saints sideline reporter. Jeff, I asked Tim Zimmer, our resident bookmaker, to give me the stats on numbers and teams traveling, and he gave me so many numbers I'm thoroughly confused, but apparently teams that travel from the West Coast to the East Coast have less of a chance of covering, but we're a Central Time Zones team. Anyway, let me ask you in a couple of minutes that we have left here about the state of the NFL in general, because as you look at the standings, man, they got some teams that are red hot that are kind of flying beneath the radar, and one of which is ahead of the Rams. I'm talking about the Cardinals. What are your thoughts on the NFL? Eagles won 6 in a row?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a very competitive league this year in terms of, like, you know, you could look at the Lions as maybe a favorite. You could look at, you know, the Chiefs and the Bills and the Ravens. There's a lot of teams kind of battling in that middle range. Like, look at the NFC West. Like, you talk about the Cardinals. Yeah, they're 6-4. The three teams behind them, Rams, Seahawks, 49ers, they're all 5-5, right? Like, the Vikings are 8-2. The Packers are 7-3. The Commanders are the last wildcard team at 7-4. So, I mean, that's why it's a strange year to be 4-7, because it seems like every team in the league is hovering around 500. So what that means is, okay, it's going to be tough to move up the standings, but it also means they're all six teams in front of the Saints remaining are beatable, right? And you look at a team like the Packers, like, yeah, it's a good team, but it's not a great team. I just watched them have to block a field goal to beat the Bears, who are the last place team in that division, but they're the last place team at 4-6, which is technically a better record than the Saints have right now. So, yeah, I mean, it's the NFL wants parity, and they've got it. My only issue is I think you've got it because of, A, injuries, and that really levels the playing field for a lot of teams. Because when you look at, okay, the Rams are 5-5, they're 4-1 since they got their players back. So the NFL has to figure out this injury problem. And then it's just quality of play. Like, I don't think you're seeing a ton of quality football in the first half of the season this year. I don't think you saw it last year. I don't think you've seen it in the last several years. Like, you don't really know who the good teams are until you get to the second half of the season, because that's when it seems like teams are finally playing good football. So I don't know. I think the NFL has to figure out its preparation schedule. I think it needs to come to terms with that, because I think those are all – that's related to injuries. It's related to poor quality play. It's related to ugly hits that lead to injuries. So I think that's where you are as a league.
Real quick. Two best teams in the NFL right now. AFC?
Ravens.
NFC. Really?
Lions. Yeah.
Ravens. Wow.
Yes.
All right. Thank you, Jeff Nowak. Pleasure as always. Follow Jeff online at Jeff_Nowak. I forgot to ask him what he's doing on the off week. All right, we'll take a break. Come back. John Alzheimer, credit expert. It is 9:08. Our next guest, John Alzheimer, is our friend, been with us for years, a credit expert, formerly of FICO and Equifax. He knows where the bumps in the road are when it comes to credit scores and credit ratings. He calls it what, John?
The fastest hour in radio.
It really is, because the questions come in and then they pour in toward the end, and unfortunately we don't get to them. So I'm going to tell y'all, now's the time. If you have any questions about your credit rating or credit score for John Alzheimer, text them into the Oakland Art Jeweler Talk and Text Line, 504-260-1870. If it's complicated and more than a text, call that number. Tim will screen your call and put you on, and John Alzheimer will answer your questions. How you doing, John? How you been?
I've been great. How about yourself?
Very well, sir. Thank you. Tell us a little bit about yourself for people to understand where you're coming from and why it is that you know so much about this.
Sure. So November is actually my 33rd anniversary in the credit environment. So I basically every year of work after I graduated from college, I've worked in some form or fashion in the credit, the consumer credit industry. So I work for Equifax, which is one of the credit bureaus, for a long time. I worked at FICO, which obviously is the company that invented credit scoring. And then since then, I've worked as an expert witness in over 800 lawsuits regarding the Fair Credit Reporting Act or the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act. I've written 4 books on the topic. So I think I got a pretty good resume with respect to credit reporting and credit scoring and credit-related issues.
Just for people that are new and didn't understand who you are and all the time we've spent with you in the past, let's talk about, I guess, the basic difference between I'll start with some general questions, and then we'll get to the audience's questions. The difference between a credit report and credit score.
Sure. So a credit report, think this is the best way I can think of to explain it, Tommy. Think of the credit report as your test. Think of your credit score as the grade you got on the test. So the credit report is essentially a list of all of your obligations that you have with various lenders. So your credit cards, your mortgages, your student loans, your auto loans, things like that. And so the credit report will contain a record of not only how well you've made your payments over time, your debt, how poorly some people make their payments over time, whether you filed bankruptcy, whether you've had foreclosures, repossessions, anything, you know, that you don't really want to have. But the flip side is if you've always paid your bills on time, then your credit report is going to contain a record of that as well. And the score is essentially a 3-digit representation of the information on your credit report. And most scores are calculated using FICO's model. So Fair Isaac Corporation is FICO, which is where FICO comes from. So their scoring models will take that data and essentially evaluate it and produce a 3-digit number ranging from 300 to 850. The higher the score, the better for the consumer. The higher the score indicates that you're lower credit risk, which means you're more likely to make your payments on time, which is why lenders pull credit reports, which is why lenders pull credit scores. And if you've got really solid scores, you're going to get really good credit offers from lenders at low interest rates with high credit limits. If you've got low credit scores, you're either going to get denied or you're going to get approved, but with higher interest rates and lower credit limits.
So it seems like if the lenders are pulling the report and the score, they're looking to see if they agree with the grade that you've gotten from FICO?
Well, it's not a matter of agreeing or disagreeing with the grade.
As far as making their decision to loan you whatever it is they want to loan you at what rate?
That's right. So what a lender wants to know, so if you walked into a branch of a bank, they don't know who you are, right? So you tell them, I want to borrow a bunch of money to buy.
They may not know who the general public is, but let's face it, John, everybody knows who you and I are.
Well, true.
Yeah.
So you walk into a bank, you want to borrow a bunch of money to buy a house or borrow a bunch of money to buy a car, or you want a credit card. So they don't know whether or not you're going to pay them back. So what do? They do the same thing that employers do. They look at your application and your background. They do the same thing that when you apply for a school somewhere, they look at how well you did in high school, look at your grades, your standardized scores. So it's really no different. They're evaluating you to determine whether or not they want to do business with you and under what terms. And the most commonly used tool in the U.S. anyways, for well over 100 years, these things aren't new, is the credit report. Since the late 80s, the credit score has been also a component of it. So obviously, think of a credit report, 20, 30 pages of information. Think of a credit score, one number. So it's very easy to build a policy around a number, because anything above a number, you're getting approved. Anything below a number, you're getting something other than approved. And so it's a very quick and fair way to evaluate the risk of doing business with a consumer. Banks want to lend you money. That's how they make their money. They don't make money by denying applications. They make money by approving applications, but they have to price them in such a way that they feel comfortable doing business with consumers. And so that's why you hear, if you've ever heard the term risk-based pricing, that's what this is. The lower your risk, the better price you're going to get. The higher your risk, the less attractive price you're going to get.
All right, so now we talk about a report being your test, the score being the grade you got on that test. Let's talk about, because I'm getting text already, about hard pulls, soft pulls, mm-hmm. Who checks what, and what can affect either your score or your report?
Yeah, so the hard pull, soft pull, what they're really asking you about are credit inquiries. And so in other words, when you, the consumer, have certain rights, and one of those rights is that it's not the wild, wild west. There has to be what's referred to in the law as a permissible purpose to pull a credit report or for a credit bureau to give out your credit report. So in other words, I can't just go pulling Tommy Tucker's credit report. I don't have a legal reason for doing so. When you go to apply for a loan somewhere, you are giving overt permission for that lender to pull a credit report. When they do so, they perform what's called a credit inquiry. They're inquiring about your credit. And when they do so, the credit bureaus are required to post a record of that inquiry. So when you apply for something and the credit report is pulled, the credit bureaus will actually log that entry into your credit report. And so that's actually our consumer right that we all have. And so we have a right to see who's looking at our credit reports. That's generally referred to as an inquiry. The example that I just gave is what's called a hard inquiry, which means that everybody can see what you just did. You can see it. Other lenders can see it. Credit scoring systems can see it. That's called a hard pull. Hard pulls can, but not always, they can lower your credit scores. A soft pull, which is a different kind of a credit inquiry, generally occurs when some lender is buying a massive list from the credit bureaus because they want to make you offers. So all these pre-approved offers you get in the mail from credit card issuers, those are the result of soft pulls. Another example of a soft pull that your audience will probably understand better than the other example is when you ask for your own credit report. When you want to pull your own credit report because you just want to see it, which you should do frequently, that also results in a soft inquiry. Soft inquiries are not seen by anybody else. Lenders can't see them. Credit scoring systems can't see them. Really, the only person that can see them is you when you pull your own credit report. So that's the kind of an inquiry 101 and the difference between the two.
But wait, when it comes to a soft pull, that seems like it's privileged information. And if credit companies are buying that information to send me a credit card offer, I didn't approve that. And who gets to look at that and who doesn't?
Yeah, it's one of the great dilemmas of the Fair Credit Reporting Act, which is that you don't necessarily have to give permission for your credit report to be used for some reason. In most scenarios, you do. There has to be actually a permissible reason, like a legitimate business purpose or underwriting or employment screening or insurance underwriting. But lenders are, in fact, allowed to essentially buy this list from the credit bureaus that will include a review of your credit report and a score in order to make you what's called a firm offer of credit. So they actually, if they do that, they have to make a firm offer of credit or insurance. They can't say, I changed my mind. I don't want to offer Tommy a credit card now. If they do it, they've got to make you that firm offer of credit. And the great way to see about the next time so for the folks listening, when you get home from work today, go check your mailbox. You may have some of these offers in your mailbox waiting for you when you get home. Look at the last page, flip it over, look at the bottom, get your glasses, because in the micro print, it will explain to you the process that happens when your credit report is used for what's called pre-screening or prospecting, and it also gives you the right to opt out and prevent them from doing things like that. But the answer to why is kind of a lame answer, but it is the real answer, is because the law allows lenders to do this. If the law did not allow lenders to do this, obviously they wouldn't be able to do it.
So who determines who gets in that club of being able to offer you that firm credit offer and before that get your information? Who's allowed in?
Yeah, the credit bureaus are they protect that ability or they kind of shield their own database from companies, and you have to not only do you have to be a legitimate lender to be able to even have an account with the credit bureaus, but you also have to prove to them that you are actually making these firm offers of credit. And in some scenarios, when I actually worked in the industry, we actually wanted to see the actual offer. Mm-hmm. So show me the template of the offer. And then they would show you this thing that was kind of marked up by a designer, and this is what the offer is going to look like, and this is what color it's going to be, this is what the envelope looks like. And so once you had a really good idea and felt comfortable that these companies, number one, were legit. And I'm not talking about Joe Blow Lender. I'm talking about Bank of America, Citibank, American. I'm talking about the actual mega banks that everybody knows and everybody is familiar with, and no one would argue that they're not legitimate lenders. But the credit bureaus maintain a really, really short leash on that process, and you have to pass a lot of criteria in order to be able to do that.
As they should. The questions are pouring in. It's the fastest hour in radio. John Alzheimer, credit expert, formerly of FICO and Equifax. John, we've spoken dozens of times. I learn something every time you're on, and I think the audience does as well. 504-260-1870. If you have a relatively simple question about credit, you can text that to the Oakland Heart Jeweler Talk and Text Line. If it's a more complicated question, you can call that same number, 504-260-1870. Tim Zimmer will screen it, and then we'll put you on with John Alzheimer, Tommy Tucker, WWL, back in a flash. 9:26, the fastest hour in radio underway with John Alzheimer, credit expert, formerly of FICO and Equifax. We've already talked about credit reports and credit scores, hard pulls, soft pulls. You can always download the Odyssey app and rewind, or just click on my name, Tommy Tucker, at WWL.com, and listen to the whole thing, because it can get a little bit confusing, and you can listen to it at your leisure. You can also text your questions into 504-260-1870. Or if it's a complicated thing, you can call that number, 504-260-1870, and John will do his best to help you. Here we go, John. I have a question for the credit expert. I was forced to do a settlement with a loan. I have the loan was cut in half. My note went down halfway. How will that affect my credit rating?
Yeah, so settlement is essentially the lender agreeing to take less than the full amount that you owe and consider the debt to be exhausted, which is a fancy way of saying that they're not going to come after you for the unpaid residual balance. So if you have a $10,000 loan and they agree to take $5,000, they've essentially settled for $5,000. They've eaten the other $5,000, which is obviously a huge loss for the lender. They're going to report that to the IRS. You may not know that, but they will, or they already have done that. And you may get a forgiveness of debt tax form from them that may have to be claimed as income in your next tax filing. So that's the bad part of settlements that people don't know a lot about when they think, oh, I got off for half of what I owe, but they don't realize they may have a tax liability, because it's essentially they've been given free money, and there is no such thing, Tommy, as you know, there is no such thing as free money. So, all right, so to finish your question, settlements are reported to the credit bureaus. There's a specific method that lenders are instructed to use when they do report a settlement. So it will show up on your credit report, and it will read something like account paid in full for less than full balance, or settlement accepted on this account, or some reasonable derivative of those two terms. And that's considered to be a derogatory event, obviously, because you didn't pay back your loan per the terms of your agreement. And that's what a credit report is meant to do, is to record how well you paid back your debts. Those are considered to be derogatory by credit scoring systems. So there's a possibility that your score could go down considerably because of the settlement. So again, these are all these are all the downsides to the upside, which is that you were able to get out of your debt for much less than what you actually owed.
And the bottom line is you're paying back pennies on a dollar, which sounds a lot like. Yeah, I don't want to use the word because it's completely different, but you understand what I'm saying.
Yeah, I do. And that's what
like the B word. Let's put it that way. It sounds a lot like
yeah.
B-word.
So that's actually what debt buyers do in some scenarios. If a lender has a large amount of defaulted debts, they may actually package all those debts together and sell them to what's called a debt buyer. And a debt buyer will pay pennies on the dollar, and then they become your new creditor, and they can report to the credit bureaus as your new credit, as your new creditor, and they can also attempt to collect from you as your new creditor, and they can even sue you as your new creditor if you don't pay them. So the pennies on the dollar thing has relevancy in the credit world because of the debt buyer scenario.
All right, let's talk about this text. I paid off my home and my score went down. Why? Nothing else changed.
Yeah, and so that's, again, that's one of the, you know, credit scores don't always move in a way that makes common sense. And so there are things that, like another really good example is, hey, I closed all my credit cards and my score went down. That doesn't make sense. Well, credit scoring systems are not built based on common sense expectations. They're built on data and the relationship between certain events and credit risk. And so one of the ones that doesn't really make any common sense is the one that you just outlined in your question. There are metrics in credit scoring systems that actually will reward you for making payments on installment debt. And if you eliminate installment debt, then you're not making payments on it any longer. And so you may, your score, it's a little bit complicated. You didn't, quote unquote, lose points. You weren't penalized because you paid off the debt. You just weren't, you were no longer reaping the rewards of proving every month that you can make that payment. Look, I get it. I'm word splicing. And ultimately what happened is your score isn't higher as it used to be. So the perception is that your score went down, which it did, but it went down because you weren't being rewarded for making the payment. You weren't penalized because you paid it off. Look, if I had zero debt on my credit report, I would be thrilled. Generally what happens when this happens to consumers is they have really, really good scores already. And so the difference between paying off the debt and the score going down a little bit is kind of immaterial in the world of borrowing, because you're still going to be able to get loans and credit cards at fantastic interest rates with fantastic terms. But I get it. And there's even data on FICO's website where they explain this kind of unusual event that occurs when people pay off their installment debts.
Next question I was going to get to says, what credit scores matter and don't, and where does it matter, where does it not matter, and how is that tied to interest rates?
Yeah, well, your interest rates are based largely off of your credit risk, and your credit risk is based largely off of your credit score. So there's a direct line between interest rates and credit scores. That's a fact, and it's been a fact for many decades. So the first part of the question was what credit scores matter. So in the U.S., there are two commonly used brands of credit scores. You have credit scores that are developed by FICO. So those would be FICO branded scores. There's more than one FICO score. There's dozens of them. Mm. And then there are the VantageScore branded credit scores. And VantageScore, people say, oh, it's new. Well, VantageScore has been around for 18 years, so it's definitely not new. Mm. VantageScore is a product, is a joint venture of the three credit reporting agencies. So Equifax, Experian, and TransUnion got together and built VantageScore as a competing model to FICO's scoring systems. FICO and VantageScore make up about 100% of the market in the United States financial services world. FICO is still the dominant credit scoring model used in the U.S., but that doesn't mean that VantageScore is immaterial or not important. Starting next year, 2025, sometime during the year, the Federal Housing Finance Agency, or the FHFA, which oversees Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, which is about 70% of the mortgages in this country, they're going to flip a switch. And when they flip the switch, all mortgages are going to be underwritten using FICO scores and VantageScore credit scores. So from a mortgage perspective, they haven't said exactly what day they're going to do this, but they keep saying sometime in 2025, then people are going to have to refocus their vision not only on FICO scores, but on FICO scores and VantageScore credit scores. So the good news is that this is actually not going to be that big of a deal. The same things matter. Relatively, the same things are important. Paying your bills on time, staying out of debt, not excessively applying for credit. If you do those things, lather, rinse, repeat, you're going to have fantastic credit scores, regardless of whether it's FICO this, FICO that, VantageScore this, VantageScore that. And the range of the scores is the same. They're both 300 to 850. So if you're not going to see these wildly different scaled scores, because they should all say the same thing about you. So if you've got killer credit, you're going to have killer credit scores regardless of the brand of scores. If you've got poor credit, you're going to have poor credit scores regardless of the score brand. So the story that's being told by the score is going to be the same. It just may not be exactly the same. So you may have FICO 800 and VantageScore 810. Not the same score, but it tells the same story. You're a really good credit risk.
So when it comes to those numbers, that's quite a range between 300 and 850. Are there breaks where it's like, okay, between 400 and 500 matters, between 500 and 700 matters? Tell me about that.
Yeah, so that is set up exclusively by lenders. And so FICO, the credit bureaus, they don't go out and say, hey, you know, you need to approve everybody above 700 and you need to decline everybody below. So that's not what those companies do. So it's up to the lender ultimately to be the one that determines what's good for them. And it's not all the same. And you don't generally see those types of, those are called risk tiers, by the way, Tommy. Mm-hmm. You don't see risk tiers published by lenders. The only place where you can really see that is for Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. They have, it's public. It's called the Selling Guide. It's on their website. It's like 1,600 pages and really boring. But you will see in there some of the information about, we consider this kind of score to be good, we consider that kind of score to be bad, we ignore certain data, we place great importance on other types of data. But generally speaking, anything, first off, anything above 780 and you're in the elite category, that's pretty much agreed upon. You're going to get the best deal on a mortgage. You're clearly going to get the best deal on a credit card and on an auto loan. Anything above 720, you're going to get the best deal on an auto loan. You're going to get the best deal on a credit card. You may not get the best deal on a mortgage loan. Anything below 720, and then believe it or not, you are below the national average. Mm-hmm. The national average is between 715 and 720, and it's been that way for many years. People think, 700 is a fantastic score. Well, 700 is below average. Mm-hmm. Anything below average is likely going to lead to some form of an approval, but maybe not the best rate. When you start getting into the mid-600s and below, that's generally considered to be subprime. Subprime is not a good word in the world of lending. There's a reason why, subprime kind of sounds nefarious, because mm-hmm. it's not good. You don't want to be subprime. If you're subprime, whenever you apply for credit, you're really rolling the dice. I might get approved. I might not. If I do get approved, my terms are not going to be good. If you're anything below 620, like down into the 500s, you're actually more likely to not make your payment. There comes a point where the scoring model tells the lender that you're more likely to not make your payments than you are to make your payments. And so as a lender, you would be stupid to lend that person money, because the likelihood is you're more likely to not get paid than you are to get paid, which is why people who have scores in the 400s, which there really aren't that many, not that many people fall that low. Really, it's the people in the 500s and the very low 600s. Those are the ones who have very limited options. The options are very expensive. And look, they're down there for a reason, right? I mean, you don't accidentally wake up one morning and you've gone from 800 to 500. There's a reason. Mm. And generally, that reason is that you're defaulting on things, you're filing for bankruptcy, you're settling debts, you're having stuff repossessed and foreclosed upon. There's a reason. And all those things indicate that you don't pay your bills well. And that's what lenders, they're going to hold that against you, right? Logically, if it was your money being lent, and I always tell people when I get into these arguments with consumer groups about credit scores and how unfair they are, I always tell them, look, okay, forget about it. Do this. Don't think about banks. Think about you. So it's $10,000 of your money, not the bank's money, your money. And I come in with FICO 500 and you're like, yeah, this guy's not going to pay me back. Are you going to lend me your $10,000? And it's amazing how all of a sudden they become conservative bankers when I'm using their money, right? Mm-hmm. So that's the score, the story that the score tells, and it's generally a pretty accurate story.
All right, let me take a break. I know this is no surprise to you, but the questions are pouring in now, as they always do in the second half of the 9 o'clock hour. Whenever John Alzheimer joins us, we'll get to as many of them as we can at 504-260-1870. Also, some general questions about how do you check your credit report or check your credit score? Where do you go to do that? Does that affect either your score or your report? Talk about all that with John. We come back 9:39, 21 till 10. Traffic now, WWL. All right, 9:45. Quickly back to John Alzheimer, credit expert, formerly of FICO and Equifax. I'm going to combine a couple of texts here about debt-to-income ratio, John. One says, is debt-to-income ratio still used by banks? The other says, is a student loan balance included in the credit ratio? Score 720, but new credit card denied because of credit ratio. And I guess we've not really talked about credit ratio, or is that the same as a credit score?
So there's two different kinds of ratios that your question just covered. One of them has nothing to do with credit scoring, and one of them does have to do with credit scoring. So the first one you asked about was debt-to-income ratio, or DTI. DTI is absolutely still considered. In fact, it's a requirement under the CARD Act from 2009. Credit card issuers have to take reasonable steps to consider your ability to pay them back. So it's a legal requirement. So DTI, basically what DTI is, Tommy, is it is the relationship between your monthly minimum payment obligations and your gross monthly income. So I'm going to use some really easy math. So if you have payment requirements of $500 a month and your gross monthly income is $1,000 a month, you divide 500 by 1,000, which is 50%. So your debt to income ratio is 50%. So what lenders use that ratio to determine is your financial capability of taking on new debt. So if you have too much of your income already being pre-reserved, if you will, for other obligations, and you may not be able to take on a new payment obligation because you simply can't afford it. That doesn't have anything to do with credit scoring. DTI is a metric of capacity, not credit worthiness. The other ratio that you asked about in your question is referred to as what's called revolving utilization, or the credit card balance to limit ratio. And so what that ratio considers is it considers all of the balances on your credit cards relative to the credit limits on those credit cards. So it's essentially what percentage of your credit card is maxed out. Is it, 80% maxed out, 10% maxed out, whatever. That ratio is considered in credit scoring systems because it's highly predictive of credit risk. So people who have heavily utilized credit cards, and now this is only a credit card metric. It doesn't consider student loans because that's an installment loan. It doesn't consider mortgages or autos because those are installment loans. It only considers credit cards, so plastic. And the higher that ratio, the fewer points you're going to earn in that category, which means your score probably isn't going to be as high as someone who has a very, very low credit card ratio, which means you are going to earn a higher score because that ratio being so low indicates that you're a better credit risk.
Let's talk generally speaking. There's been a lot of text about this, about dealing in cash and not credit, and the relationship between credit score or credit reports to insurance premiums.
So I'm going to answer the second one first. So credit reports. So again, people always ask why, how can they do that? And the answer is because the law allows them to. So the answer to the why is because they're allowed to. And there is a very well-established, consumer advocates hate this, but it's true. There is a very well-established relationship between your credit reports and what kind of an insurance customer you're going to be, even though you would think logically that, wait a minute, one of them is my loans and credit cards, the other is my insurance. But it has been repeatedly proven scientifically that how you manage your credit is predictive of what kind of an insurance customer you're going to be, specifically auto insurance and homeowners insurance. So certainly, yes, insurance companies, as part of the underwriting process, are perfectly allowed to, under federal law, to look at your credit reports, consider the insurance credit scores that are calculated from your credit reports, as part of whether or not they want to give you coverage and what kind of premiums you're going to pay. So that is absolutely a real thing, and it's a real thing because it's legal. I will be honest, I missed the first part of the question. It has escaped me, so if you want to re-ask
the first part. It was about student debt, and how does that factor into it?
Yeah, so student loans
is a student loan balance included in the credit ratio?
No, it's not, because student loans are installment loans, and installment debt is not part of that credit card utilization ratio that I just talked about. But certainly, yes. Look, if you have student loans are an interesting animal, because most people, when they go to college, they take out multiple student loans to pay for multiple semesters of school. So what you end up with those are all independent loans. People don't realize that. So if you take five or six loans out over the course of your college career, that's five or six loans that are going to show up on your credit report. So it's important that you pay your student loans on time for obvious reasons, meaning it's an obligation, you agreed to pay it back, you should do it. But if you start missing payments on your student loans, it's going to show up as late payments on five or six accounts on your credit report, which is obviously more problematic than if you just had one missed payment on a credit report. So if you have student loans and you have not looked at your credit reports lately, I encourage you to do so just so you can see, hey, look, how many student loans do I actually have? How are my payments being applied when I make my payment to the servicer every single month, just to make sure that they're being applied appropriately and you don't have a bunch of late payments across a bunch of loans on your credit reports.
Real quick, balance transfers?
So I love them, but I love them if they're used appropriately and strategically. And most people will transfer balances on credit cards to either other credit cards that have lower interest rates or no interest grace periods, or they will use personal loans to pay off credit cards, which is essentially converting revolving debt, which is much more expensive, to installment debt, which is much less expensive. So I love moving money around strategically like that, as long as you're doing it for the right reason, which is to either get it into a position where it's cheaper, you can pay it off faster, or it's less problematic for your credit score. I don't like moving the strategy of moving money around just because you're kind of treading water and it's really just avoiding some sort of a disaster because you're not going to make payments on the loans anyway. So yes, but only if you're using them for the right reason.
You don't want to get caught in that financial riptide, and that's not just a metaphor. It's true. Let's talk about how people can check their own credit rating, credit score for free. Where do they go? Does it count against them, et cetera, to wrap this up, John?
Yep. So there's obviously there's a lot of places where you can get your credit reports. I always advise consumers to go to the single government-approved, and in this case, that's a good thing, government-approved and mandated website. It's annualcreditreport.com. Don't misspell anything because you end up at the wrong website. Annualcreditreport.com. That's the website where you can go and claim federally mandated free copies of your credit report. The credit bureaus will allow you to claim your credit reports once a week, even though the law says they only have to do it once every 12 months. Ever since COVID, they actually kind of unlocked that website. Now, to the extent you want to pull all three of your credit reports 52 times, you're certainly allowed to do that. You won't get a credit score from that website, but you can get FICO scores, Vantage scores from any number of places at no cost. Experian gives them away for free on their website. There's a boatload of other websites where you can get free FICO scores and free Vantage scores. Look, my point is that if you end up on a website that's asking you for your credit card number to get one of these things, you're on, leave the website and go somewhere else. There's so many places to get these things for free that you don't need to be buying them anymore.
And if we go to annualcreditreport.com, does that count against you, or does it matter how often you go, or what?
No. You may remember at the beginning of the hour, Tommy, we talked about soft inquiries and how they're entirely benign.
Right.
When you pull your credit reports from annualcreditreport.com, that leaves a soft inquiry on your credit report, which means that only you will be able to see it. What you don't want to do, and what I see happen sometimes, is that, hey, I got a buddy who works at the auto dealership, or hey, I got a buddy who works, and they go to one of them to pull the credit report, and then it looks like you applied for credit.
It's like a hard pull, exactly. Thank you, John. Invaluable information as always. John Alzheimer, have a nice Thanksgiving holiday season if we don't talk to you. Credit expert formerly of FICO and Equifax, a lot of information in the hour. You go to WWL.com. When Tim posts the audio, click on my name or download the Odyssey app. Use the rewind feature. We'll find out what Noel's got planned for you today when we come back on WWL.